Accession number 20271, Reel 1.
Ron Hill, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
In Liverpool.
Which year was this?
1930.
Okay. Did you grow up and have your schooling in Liverpool, please?
I did indeed, and I was also a member of the Sea Cadet Corps.
How did you come to be a member of that?
At the local school. I went to Florence Melly School and in Norwich Green, and they had I think one of the teachers there formed part of the Sea Cadets. And eventually I joined the Sea Cadet unit, and I became one of only three members of the Sea Cadet Corps in Liverpool to sport the wireless badge. Because my father was a signaller in the army in India in the 20s, and he taught me heliograph, which is sending Morse by light, which of course, so I learnt the Morse code, and the original phonetic alphabet that they used to learn in the army before the main one came in during the war. And one of my fortes is to sing this, like, ah, dear Johnny Don, Neddy Freddy George, Harry Ink, Johnny King, and the Monkey Notes, etc.
Carry on, sing the whole thing.
All right, we'll start again, shall we? Dear Charlie Don, Neddy Freddy George, Harry Ink, Johnny King, London Monkey Nuts, Orange Pip Queen, Roger Sugar Tock, Uncle Victor Willie, and then we had X-Ray, Yoker, Zebra. And then, of course, when we joined the Navy, a lot of it changed and it went to Abel Baker, Charlie Dog, Easy Fox George, which you can tell the difference. Which is the one we were taught in the Navy. And then, of course, in 1951, the now familiar phonetic alphabet, which is your normal Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo, Foxtrot, Golf, etc., came into force. When the Americans and us combined during the Korean War came in 1951.
And that original one you sang?
The original one? Oh, 1920s. In fact, you see, that's where some of the things came out. They talk about Ack Emma, because it used to start off, you know, Ack Beer, Johnny Don, Eddie Freddy George, which, of course, you don't hear today. But what I do, I've got an amateur radio call sign, and I still talk G3 Sugar George Queen. And now I've even got another guy on the net. His call sign is SGU. So he calls himself Sugar George Uncle, which so it's a bit of fun. Rolls up the tongue better.
Have you got any Second World War memories?
Second World War? Well, I always remember I used to live in a place called Daneville Road in Norwich Green, and during the war we had air raid shelter in the garden, and my father had a very ancient tin helmet, and I climbed out of the it was during the May Blitz in 1941, and I was hit by shrapnel onto this tin helmet. I don't know what happened to it, but there was a great big dint, so lucky I was wearing my dad's tin helmet. Piece of a shell come down, because it all round, it used to go to school the next day and used to pick up bits of shells, and you know, and then used to swap them for either stamps or whatever people wanted during a war, you know. And then I was evacuated because I passed the 11 plus and I went to St. Margaret's Anfield, a secondary modern school, and I was evacuated in the war. And I went to a little village called Ponkiau, P-O-N-C-I-A-U, near Wrexham. Nobody spoke English. So I was in my second year of French, and when I came back from Wales, I was in my second year of Welsh. That gives you some, this is true. And then I went back to school, and because I was so far behind my French, I took up shorthand and bookkeeping. Well, the shorthand, of course, believe it or believe it not, was Greg. And I used to know it, I learned it very, very well, which stood me in good stead when I joined the Navy properly. But Greg died out and it all became Pittman's. So that died a natural death.
Were you happy as an evacuee?
The very first words I learned in Welsh was Vidi Nesa, which means I'm the next, because every night I was sent to the local fish and chip shop across the road with threepence, and if you didn't speak Welsh, she wouldn't serve you. So the first words I learned was I'm the next in Welsh. And it was threepence worth of fish and chips every night the whole time I was there. And that was your supper.
Were any of them unable to speak English?
Well, when you went to school, nobody spoke English in the classroom. That's why you had to learn Welsh.
But could they speak English?
I've no idea. I mean, remember, I'm only, 10, 11 years of age. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I'll never forget, there was a young girl called Brenda May Hughes. I was only about 11 and she was about 12 or 13. And she took charge of me. And she used to walk me to school and walk me back from school. And one day on HMS Plymouth, we had visitors from North Wales. And I happened to remark. I said, where'd you come from? They said, near Wrexham. So I said, I was evacuated near Wrexham to a place called Ponky. We come from Ponky. So then I was telling them where I lived. It was called Eston Villa, Johnson Street. And I belonged to the Zion Chapel, you see. Because you had your own little seats, all those in the little village had your own seats, and we were in the gods in our own little seats in the Zion Chapel. So I was telling them about that, and they said, well, when we go back, we'll find out about Brenda May Hughes and where you used to live and everything else. And I said, okay. Well, 2, 3, 4 months later, I'd forgotten all about it. And all of a sudden, I had a letter with photographs of where I used to live. Brenda May Hughes was married. She had a 21-year-old son. Her husband had died, and she died. And they offered me, they said, would I like the address of her son? I thought, well, no. You know what I mean? What does he know about me, and I don't know him? You know what I mean? But it was interesting to know that she died, and the husband had died, and they had a 21-year-old son.
How do you spell Ponkay?
P-O-N-C-I-A-U, near Wrexham. And I also belong to We Are the Oval Teeny Little Girls and Boys. And a bus used to leave the Ponkay village full of evacuees to run us to Wrexham on a Saturday, not saying every Saturday, for the kids' matinee in Wrexham.
Were you discriminated against at all?
No, part of the family, until you learnt a bit of Welsh. You know, it was. How can you? I mean, remember, you're only a kid, and you're dealing with children. You're working with your own mates, and you're learning words all the time. And even today, on Channel 4, you know, S4C, when it comes on, sometimes I can still hear and remember some of the words I used to listen to and used to use. I mean, going back years, you know.
Did the war affect them at all in Ponkay?
No. There was no air raids or anything like that. It was just in the middle of nowhere. You know what I mean?
What did they all do for a living?
Can't answer that. All I know is there was no men in the house. The mother was there. And the daughter. And the daughter was looking after the mother and the house. I don't know where the men were. There was myself and one other. We were the last two on the station in Wrexham. You know, scruffy little kids, you know what I mean? And two little boys. And one of them was a right scouser. Came from Kensington somewhere in the town. Never ever saw him again. His mother came one day and took him away. And then, months and months and months later, my mother came and said, right, we're going back now, because the Blitz had finished.
Have you any more bombing memories from Liverpool?
On a Sunday, we always, my mother, of course it was coupons during the war, and my mum had bought me a brand new suit. Now remember, the suits in them days were shorts and a jacket. Because I even went to school, I never owned long trousers till I joined the Navy. I joined the Navy in a pair of shorts, school shorts. Got the idea? Well, Mother dressed us up one Sunday, and on a Saturday night, an ammunition train had blown up in Club Moor in Liverpool. Well, we used to collect the shrapnel, as I mentioned before. So away we go, and of course I'm picking up loads and loads of shrapnel and putting it all in my brand new suit's pockets. And by the time I got back home again, all the pockets inside were all in shreds, as you can imagine. And Mother did her nuts, and I got a belt. So that's about the only real ones. There was no... We had a doctor's surgery at the corner of the road under what they call Broadway Bridge. And a landmine hit the doctor's surgery, and it was a huge house. And I think there was about 6 people killed in the surgery. Yeah.
Were you ever frightened during the war?
I've no recollection of it.
Were you interested in the progress of the war?
Well, remember, you're only 10 or 11 years of age, and I don't really think places didn't convey anything to us. You know, when you talk about Normandy and places like that in 44. But then, with the Sea Cadets, you were watching the progress of the Navy. You know what I mean? The Hood went up. And then the Prince of Wales and the Repulse went up off Singapore in 1942-43. And then the Hood went down. And, of course, we had little memorial services. Because you were, you know, still in naval uniform, if you like. But you had SCC on your hat.
Why had you joined the Sea Cadets?
I always wanted to join the Navy. Always wanted to join the Navy. Don't ask me why.
How did you go about joining the Navy in the end?
I left school at 15. In those days, being in a selective central school, you didn't leave school till you were 15 years of age. But of course, the ordinary schools, you left at 14. And you couldn't join the Navy until you were 15 and a half years of age. That was your minimum age for joining. I could have joined as a Royal Marine bugle boy at 14. But I always wanted to be a sailor. And of course, my wireless badge on my arm, the communicator's badge, as we learnt after the look, my wireless operator's badge, and there were only 3 of us in Liverpool, that's what I'm saying. I was very proud of that badge. And when I joined up, I said, I want to be a signalman like my dad. Because my father was a signaller in the army. But a signaller in the army is totally different to a signaller in the Navy. So when we came to, I passed all my tests. Remember, everybody joins the Navy as a boy seaman second class. And then you sit little examinations. And I'm proud of my writing and my spelling. Well, going to a central school, I was very, very proud of that. And in the finish, I was selected for what I wanted to be, a signalman. The signalman in the Navy, he came out and he put a pair of flags on my arm. And I burst into tears. I said, what are you doing? I'm a sparker. I'm a da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh, you want to be a radio operator? Well, a signaller in the army, you see, is a radio operator. You understand what I'm saying? But they had flags on their arms. And when they gave me these flags, only had them for 24 hours, and they replaced them with the sparker's badge. And eventually, of course, I went up. And became a radio operator and went through the ranks, no problem.
Where were you trained, first of all, in the Navy?
In the HMS St. George in the Isle of Man. It was Cunningham's holiday camp. And then at the end of the war, another little funny story, they reopened the boys' training establishment, HMS Ganges, in a place called Shotley in Suffolk, near Ipswich. Now, because we were transferring from HMS St. George to the Ganges, we had to pack our kit up. Now, when you join the Navy, you have to sew your names in every piece of kit that you've got. Literally sew it in. And because my name was R.C. Hill, I'd finished about 3 or 4 weeks before everybody else. Consequently, I shall never forget a chap called Harry S. Vincent Spall. It was Vincent hyphen Spall. And what they did to me was, you finished your kit, start sewing his in, because he was way behind. And to this day, I'll never forget that guy. Harry S. Vincent hyphen Spall, and that was his name. And he was in the same. But the funny part is, we got a week's extra pay and off leave, because all your kit was transferred from there to HMS Ganges while we were on leave, you see. I was on a ship called HMS Charybdis in the 70s, and this happened to come up in conversation. And next to me was a chap, the same rank as myself, a chief, and we were what they call fifth fivers. In other words, we'd done our 22, and we were doing an extra 5 years each, right? So he was a fifth fiver. And he says to me, hang on, he says, you came from St. George in the Isle of Man to Ganges? I said, yes, I carried your bloody kit bag, he says. He was, people who joined after us had gone to Ganges and were standing by in the annex, waiting for all the rest of us to come from the St. George in the Isle of Man. And he was one of the guys that was umping all the kit out of the lorries into the various messes. That's absolutely true, that. And he was the buffer. And he never let me forget it. Every time the tot come up, I carried your bloody kit bag, so you had to give him slippers, you know.
What was the training like at St. George?
St. George was very, very good. You lived in cabins, because obviously it was a holiday camp. When we went to Ganges, they tried to reopen Ganges as it was before the war, a very, very strict boys' training establishment. And the commander, he cracked down, and in the first 3 or 4 months there was over 1,000 deserters. You couldn't go far because it was right on the coast. But we were all so fed up with the regime after what we'd been used to in St. George. For example, you were allowed to smoke in St. George. Various times, but you were allowed to smoke. They cracked down. No smoking. You used to get your little... Do you ever remember stuff called a teapot?
No.
When you did your washing, you didn't have washing powder. So you were issued with a little... like a top glass of, like, washing up liquid. Very, very powerful. And on your way down, you could go and take it down there and do your dobing the way you wanted to do it. When you went to Ganges, there were chiefs and POs standing over you with stomachers. What is a stomacher? It's a hunk of rope with a Turk's knot in the end of it. And remember, you're only 15, 16, 17, well, coming up to 16. And they were knocking hell out of you. So a lot of us ran away. We didn't get very far. But the next thing that happened, the commander was relieved. And a commander joined us called Commander Hopkins. I'll never forget this guy. And all of a sudden it went back. I'm not saying to the same regime as what we had in St. George, but all of a sudden things eased up.
So you deserted yourself?
Oh, yes. Didn't get very far. About a day out, then all the local police and everything else. You know, I was just one of the thousand. But as I say, you couldn't go very far. Because you just walked across the beach. You know what I mean? It was on an outcrop. On one side of the river was Harwich, on the other side was Lowestoft. So the all rounders are up centre back. Of course, there's a big court of inquiry, you see, about why all these kids were roaming the countryside. Because we just couldn't live with it. We were so shocked after what we'd been used to, because we'd been in the Navy then. What, 6, 7 months, you see, over in the Isle of Man. And it was everything. We were learning things. And
Did somebody organise this? These desertions?
Well, I think it became general. Anybody was doing it, you know, so you just joined the gang just to get away, you know. And then the local police saw everybody turned out, rounding us up. Don't think anybody ever got further than about, say, half a mile away. Because it means it was in the depth of winter. We'd only just joined, you see, in the January 1946. Because we'd been transferred after the extra week's leave, you know. So, and then that's, anyway, after that, things eased up. But we always prided ourselves. When you went to Ganges, they tried to teach you arms up to the shoulders, you know, in the marching. In other words, like pussies, you watch anybody, the army, and they're like this, rigid. In the St. George, we used to swing our arms, if you like, as normal, as you normally do. Not up to the shoulders. And we used to close up ranks. In other words, instead of having a space between you and the... We all used to close up. It was our way of, we're St. George boys. That makes sense. You understand what I mean? And the chief GIs, the gunnery instructors, used to hate this. Used to hate it. But and when they told us this, we would for a little while. And then when they changed, we'd go back to normal. And even today, we were proud to say, they want me to join the Ganges Association. In fact, I was going to go down there on the 7th, 8th and 9th until this happened. And I've had to cancel it. I'm not a Ganges boy. I'm from the St. George. And it's a little point, if you like to say. I'm proud of it.
What happened after you finished at Ganges?
You went straight to HMS Mercury, which was the signal school. And when we went there, there was how many in the class? About 18, I think. But remember, you're a mixture of buntings, in other words, your signalmen, and your sparkers. And we had a choice of ships, because you're only boys, remember. And one of the ships was HMS Theseus, which was an aircraft carrier. And the other one was HMS Warrior, which was also an aircraft carrier. And the only other ship was HMS Mauritius, which was a cruiser. So myself and a guy called Titch McCarthy, we said, but we don't want a carrier. We'll go for the cruiser.
Why didn't you want a carrier?
Too big. You know, we thought a cruiser would be nice. We didn't want a carrier. The Theseus was trooping to and from the Caribbean, right? 3 months out, 3 months home. The Warrior was trooping to and from the Far East, 3 months out, 3 months home. I was stuck in the Med for 2.5 years. So you can imagine.
Yeah. What was it like in the Mauritius?
Oh, beautiful. You know, I mean, big ship. You had all the facilities. You had a regular cinema show. You had your SRE. And remember, you're in the boys' mess. So whenever you went ashore, you were only allowed boys' shore leave, which normally was something like 11 o'clock in the morning till, say, 11 o'clock in the forenoon till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You weren't allowed out overnight or late at night. You had to go ashore and come back again.
How were boys generally treated in the ship?
Very good. We had our own mess deck. And I'll be honest with you, a chap... It's a story behind this, and I won't mention his name in case it's reproduced. He'd spent all the war years in the Mediterranean, and he was a chief. Now, the chief is God. He's the bloke in charge of the communications branch. You understand what I mean? See, the chief PLTEL. And he got drafted to HMS Cleopatra, which was another cruiser. The Mauritius was part of the first cruiser squadron. And in the squadron, you had the Leander, the Cleopatra, beautiful ship called the Ajax, which took part in Battle of the River Plate. I think that was sold to India and became INS Delhi, I think, later on, and HMS Liverpool. Well, he got drafted to the Cleopatra as the chief of the Cleopatra. And according to him, I can only tell you what he told me later on, he says, I asked to go anywhere but the Med. He'd spent all his war years in the Met. And he said, I asked if I could have anywhere, but not the Met. Anyway, they sent him out to the Cleopatra. And he got so annoyed, he went ashore, and they didn't see him for a week. He got drunk on gin. They sent him back to the Cleopatra. Oh, they dipped him to... Do you understand the meaning of the term dipped? They demoted him to P Hotel, still keeping his draft sheet to the Cleopatra. So after he'd been stopped leave for a fortnight, he went ashore again. And they dipped him down to Killick. In other words, he's now gone down to from if you like, the sergeant major to a sergeant to a corporal. And they still kept him on board the Cleopatra. So in the finish, he went ashore after he'd stopped his leave and everything, and he got drunk again, so they sent him to us. And they put him in charge of the boys' mess. And there was never a better bloke you ever met. He was a big Irish chap, and he had one of these big leather belts, not the navy belt, you know, with the crisscross leather. And he was senior as a chief, more senior than the chief we had on board. And he knew, you never had radio electricians in them days. You were what they call user maintainers. So in other words, you used to repair the sets as they broke down. So they made him the repairer. And by luck or good judgment, I was selected to go with him and do the job with him. And that's how I became technical oriented. So the first thing we did, we cleared out all the valve storages. There's millions of valves on a cruiser. But you can use the search for the things. So we put them all in order and, you know, had them all worked out. And every time we worked on a set, I'm with him. And then one day he says, well, we've done this before. We did this last week. I want you to solder this, solder that, put that in, change the base. All of a sudden I learned so much more. It was a boon to me. I felt sorry for the guy. And eventually we came home in, I think, 1948, and I never saw him again. But what a cracking guy. And I mean that. I learned an awful lot from this man. Yeah, I felt sorry for him. But as a man in charge of the boys' mess deck, and he was so clean and tidy and smart, and you know what I mean? But show him a bottle of gin when he went ashore, and that was it. Because he was just so fed up being in the Med. Cracking guy. I can tell you his name, but I won't, in case it comes out later on. And then from there...
Which places did Mauritius visit?
We were all around the Med. One of the finest places we ever went to was a place called Izmir. Izmir in Turkey. I'll never forget that. But of course, what you've got to bear in mind is, I've got a lot of photographs upstairs, I think, in the attic. Do you remember the illegal immigrants coming to Palestine at the end of the war? Well, there were two big ships. I got a big recommend for this. Unbeknown to myself, I mean, I didn't know. As a boy tell, they don't know what to do with you in the office. But I could type, because I was a touch typist. I became one of the first Morse typists, because during the war, the speed of Morse increased and increased and increased. There was so much going on that in the finish, you can't write faster than 20 words a minute. So in boys' training, they taught us to touch type. And then on a keyboard with all the keys blacked out. So you had to decipher the right letter of the Morse and type the right key. Do you understand what I'm saying? But you learned touch at Pittman's. In fact, later on in life, I was stuck in Devonport before I joined the Royal Naval College in Dartmouth in 1963. And there was QARNS. There were three QARNS nurses there. And they said to me one day, would you like to teach them typing? And I did. I taught the three of them. It took me about 3 weeks, I think, or 4 weeks, something like that. Mind you, that was every day. And he used to use records, you know. And it was Pittman's. on the third beat commence, and it was a dan 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 dan.